Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest is Brandy Martin Yu, an artist in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Based in Brooklyn, she holds an MFA from the School of Visual Arts in New York. Her work includes sculpture, video, installations, and images. Brandy, welcome to the Seminary Explores.
Well, thank you so much.
So, what are metacognitive objects?
I have to say, I'm kind of proud of the phrase, and I Googled it to make sure, you know, it only came up in, like, one German paper, so I was like, yay, I came up with the thing. So I taught art for 20 years, and I can't remember where I first learned what metacognitive means, but, you know, thinking about thinking, and that, you know, became, like, the core of my teaching. Getting kids to notice their own thinking processes and be critical of them, and then look at the things around them to see, basically to observe themselves observing, and then also to critique. You know, kids walk through and like, oh, the teacher hates me. It's like, well, to be more critical without telling them to be critical of their education, but just sort of giving them the tools for that. And when I first started my MFA, I, you know, had retired early from teaching, and because it's like, you know, life is short, I really wanted to be an artist, and I can't be a good teacher and a good artist. So I was trying to not do art about teaching. And because there's kind of a, no matter what anyone says, there's a definite prejudice in the, I think, well, maybe anywhere, you know, but secondary, elementary education. So I was trying to stay away from that. And what I started to realize is whether art is teaching or teaching is art is kind of a stupid question. The real question is, I don't do this in my art because I like teaching. I was attracted to teaching and art for the same reasons.
Oh, excellent.
Because they are both thinking about thinking. And that's why when I taught, I couldn't do art, because it satisfied all that intellectual curiosity that I had. So a metacognitive object is something you would encounter in an art gallery, or really it wouldn't have to be art, that as you observe it and you can't quite figure it out, you can't quite put it together. Cognitive dissonance is too strong of a word, but something doesn't fit, and you have to kind of fit it together. And as you do, you're like, oh, I thought this, but now I think that. And to whether or not you know or care about the word metacognitive, that's what would happen. And I like it to be with things. I mean, I also do video and digital images and stuff like that, but to me it's not the entering the brain more than one way. Like, even if you don't touch an object, you imagine touching it, as all security guards know in every art museum. So that's what I mean. And it's a good term, because they asked me at my thesis, like, do you tend these to be art objects or educational?
Interesting.
And I thought, well, do I have to pick one? But apparently you do. So I made up my own category.
I also find that really interesting, because there are a lot of stereotypes about people who are, for example, not artists themselves, or are just sort of unfamiliar with it. They tend to talk about art as being self-expression, and you're talking about the critical thing. You're talking about sort of the opposite, and it's refreshing to hear that, because there are so many assumptions and stereotypes about the purpose of making art. And
And there's, you know, that it's a perfectly valid reason to make art, but I think I worked through this talking through so many high school students, but you can say, well, art expresses how I feel, but really does anyone care how you feel?
Yes.
They don't. Mm-hmm. They care how they feel.
Right.
And to tap into something, I mean, you have to work through that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying artists mm-hmm. shouldn't do that. They mm-hmm. should. And if you do it in a truly universal way, you know, like a good book, mm-hmm. you put yourself in their place. But if you can't put yourself in their place, you don't care.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, even though this isn't autobiographical or always have, like, emotions to it, it's sort of the emotion that people bring to it because it's a little bit, well, sterile is too strong of a word, but there's space.
Mm-hmm.
There's space for people to enter into it
mm-hmm.
and feel like they are the actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of watching a play, they're given some lines and some material and can go with it, I guess it would be a good analogy.
There's a similar thinking or responses to writing poetry, because I would say the same thing. It is not about self-expression. Like,
no.
Keep that in your journal. That's very valid, and it's very important. Right. And I think, you know,
you should write 100 of those
right.
before you write anything
exactly.
else.
Yeah. But there is a difference between what you do for self-expression and what you say, you know, if I edit this, I think this might be ready to bring into the public. And then, of course, because, you know, how you're feeling or thinking about something does not really matter. But if you have something that really kind of is ready to be shown, and it's something that that sort of goes beyond you, mm-hmm. and other people are able to, so whether it's visual art or writing, it will trigger things, and if it's done well, it will trigger things in other people, and this space that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
then they will be able to cross, and it will mean something to them, and that's what you're looking for. And so it's so interesting that I hear this often with both, especially poetry and fine art, just this sort of, oh, it's about expression. I'm like,
No. Well, I, a couple, these seem random, but I swear I'll tie them together. Like, every once in a while, a high school student would say, oh, you know, or frankly, an adult would be like, I'm really into poetry. Have always been, like, I'm a poetry, subscribed to Poetry Magazine mm-hmm. kind of poetry geek.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a high school kid would come up and be like, oh, would you read one of my poems? And I'd say, oh, sure. And inside mm-hmm. I'm like, adolescent poetry, uh-huh. you know. you know, and sometimes I wouldn't read it until I'm like, well, who are some of your favorite poets?
Because
I remember hearing Fiona Apple, is that her name? I don't know. She writes songs. And
Mm-hmm.
She also. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she said someone asked her that in an interview, and she's like, oh, I don't like to read it. I just like to write it. And I thought, oh.
Ding, 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 ding.
Go away. Be quiet. Uh-huh. So I don't actually, that was a long time ago, and I don't know if it's true, so don't, mm-hmm. no slander intended. But what you were saying about the emotion and something deeper, like it, I think of it like flesh and bone, you mm-hmm. know. You really, there's a Molly Peacock poem about petting a pet mm-hmm. and how you're actually feeling for the bone under the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's such a great piece. I actually, on a similar thing about editing and reducing,
mm-hmm.
I went through a period where I'm like doing gratitude, like
mm-hmm.
emailing or writing people that I feel I owe something to who may or may not know. And she's one of them, you know, Molly Peacock,
wow.
my favorite poet since age 19.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote her a letter about how I took one of her poems, A Squirrel Disappears, or A Squirrel on a Wire mm-hmm. over the backyard. And there's the wire shakes, and there's a brief bottomless disbelief in plenty, and how the tiny backyard is love, and something in that. Like, I was mm-hmm. like, whoa. And so I actually wrote that poem down,
uh-huh.
and I'm at my boyfriend's house, who I thought was going to break up with me soon. And so I actually wrote that poem, and then I put it inside the back of a picture frame so that when he opened it to take my picture out, he'd read that poem. Like, I knew it was coming. Like, see, I wanted to be right. So that's not a very good relationship situation. But so I told her that story, and then I said, I teach high school art, and kids ask, why do I have restraints? Because isn't art just whatever you want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yuck, gag mm-hmm. me. No. Talk about how restraints help. Like, she writes in a sonnet, but yet it's very contemporary. It's not mm-hmm. Shakespearean. And so, anyway, so that's my email to her, and her response, like, it took a couple months, so I was just like, oh. But then she wrote me back, and she said, your email made my week. month, my year, and how she wished she wrote novels because she would write a novel where someone did that. And she really liked the analogy I made about an apple. Like, you cut an apple in half, and you don't need both halves to understand what's inside the apple. You can do without, you know. So editing form limitations, and she said that that was a really great line. And so even though I don't write poetry, really, I was just like, well, now I know I could have, because Molly Peacock said I wrote a good line. But these things keep coming back to me, things that this is how I know I'm on the right track with my work. Instead of wondering about whether or not it's a good idea, as I'm doing it, I keep realize how much I'm bringing. Like, I'm just doing something technical, and I remember my dad teaching me that when you change a tire, you know, you don't change the nuts and bolts in a circle. You always go opposite, and you always do a little at a time so that it doesn't get skewed, and, you know, it moves in and is fast and securely and evenly. And so I'm doing something else, but it reminds me of that. Or, you know, I think about, you know, the woods when I was a kid, and running through the snow was kind of like this. And a lesson I taught, you know, that had a theme, and I'm like, whoa, this, you know, so I'm if I'm drawing in everything from my whole life, whether it's technical or a memory, or really it's connecting the dots. It's finding a thought, you know, that I had in fourth grade, to a lesson I taught, to, you know, a talk I gave, to, like, whoa. You know?
Well, and when you're, as an artist, when you're connecting these dots, you're allowing viewers to connect. That's where kind of the magic happens, is when the viewer, when it triggers something in them, when they're looking at or hearing something and it triggers something in them, and you're sort of making that spit, you're setting up, you're sort of editing and setting up an opportunity for that to happen. And that's one of the most satisfying feelings ever, if you see something, if someone else is reminded, you know, like, nothing kicks ass like a metaphor. Right?
That's true.
And when you that self-realization, when the viewer or the reader is sort of taken on their own path, like, that's...
I thought, actually, that was... I mean, of course, visual aids, I'm an artist. I think that's important with teaching. But I think my strongest... One of my strongest qualities as an educator was analogy. Like, I don't have a thing, but I'm like, this is like this. Or I'd even say, close your eyes, and I would say, picture this. And the reason it's better than showing them a picture is they're constructing the image. When you use a metaphor, people are building it themselves.
Well, why don't you describe the project that you're doing here in Gettysburg at the National Military Park?
Sure. I am taking, again, I've been working a lot with words, and I think one of the reasons I've been using text and words is because people visualize it, you know, they read the words and then they come up with an image. And so I've been taking some of Walt Whitman's poetry about the Civil War from, it's called Drum Taps, and that's all of his Civil War poems, and finding these really evocative phrases or the most moving that are appropriate to different parts of the park, and then creating casting metal letters and assembling the, you know, the text or the poem fragment in, say, a concrete paver looking thing, a plaque, and the metal letters are raised up so that if you touch them, you know, you can feel the smooth letters and the rough concrete underneath, and then placing them throughout the park, and then almost hiding them, and then meeting people in the visitor center at a table, explaining the project, maybe having a sample one there with a pile of newsprint and half crayons, you know, peeled crayons, and giving them the GPS coordinates, and they can use their phone or GPS or, you know, follow someone who does, and go in and locate, you know, struggle to locate these. It's not just like, it's by the, you know, Minnesota Memorial. It's by the church. It would be like they would discover what the place is by approaching it. You know, they don't necessarily know they're approaching the Minnesota or whatever. And so they they work to find these words. They find the words, and they do a rubbing, so the words are actually showing up. I mean, they can see them, but when you put the paper and you do the rubbing, you're literally remaking that text. You know, you found the location. You are remaking the text. You are watching the words appear as you rub the crayon, which is always magical. I mean, people do this in Europe and in India and other, you know, a lot sacred places. And so people could go and get each of the phrases in their entirety in any order. Or as I would also encourage people, creative way to read this would be to go through and pick your favorite words out only and try to make your own phrase, your own sentence out of what you find, because that is, I don't know, as an educator or as an intellectual, I mean, to me, how we rebuild language ourselves is how we really understand things. So, and there's, you know, a lot of philosophers and, you know, other people who feel that, you know, if the reader remakes the text or actually makes the text real. So by going out there and doing that, they're literally making visible a process that is sort of philosophical and abstract. So,
and it also has this interesting sense of continuity, because there's an awareness, even if you're just doing single words, these are the words of Walt Whitman, and you are doing this activity on the battlefield.
Exactly.
And yeah.
And so he might have been in, I don't actually know from my research that I did from, like, these aren't necessarily specific to Gettysburg, I guess. It's the Civil War in general, but, you know, it's carnage everywhere.
Yeah.
And there was a couple, like some of the lines I picked, which of course now I'm giving it away, right? So, I have nourished the wounded and soothed many a dying soldier, and at intervals waiting or in the midst of camp, compose these songs. So, sort of making his process transparent, but it recreates that scene, right? Like, these aren't written in an atelier in France, you know. He's sitting there, you know, in the middle of misery and waiting for the next wave of misery, and quickly writes down some words, you know, to capture what's happening and to be out in the field with those words that he wrote. You're remaking them where he made them, or a similar situation is, I think, a more visceral way than to necessarily buy the book and read it. Not that I'm against books. And then this other one that I love, and this is sort of the conclusion, sort of at the end of Drum Tap. So, answer, that you are here, that life exists, and identity, that the powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. I was like, I'd already had the idea when I read this phrase, you know, and I was like, woo, you know, this completely fits, which would be a great ending way, you know, to go through this, you know, history and someone's creative process and the, not just reliving the experience, but reliving, you know, like I said, the process. And then at the end, it's like, well, now that you understand process, how would you like to contribute, you know, to this flow of history and to other people remake what you've done, et cetera, et cetera. So, that's...
Yeah, that sense of a continuum. Is,
participate. It's not... You're not out collecting some facts to put in your bucket of knowledge. It's... You are part of a flow. We constantly rebuild it. Things are lost, but things are kept and things are added. And, you know, like our understanding of the Civil War, of course, wouldn't be what it was at the turn of the century or what it was 20 years after. You know, for a long time, the South was not allowed to build monuments to their states. Like, only the Union was allowed to do that. So, obviously, that understanding of what the war means and what it means to everyone and what closure means and what unification means and things like that. So, you know, it means something else. Actually, it's starting to sound familiar again, right? These unbridgeable divides, which is something else I've been thinking about a lot. So,
So maybe one of your next pieces.
Yes,
will be.
Right.
And so what has it been like? It, on the battlefield, like in the cannon shop and on your tour? And what yes. have you experienced?
Well, the highlights have been, first of all, they treat us very well. This is a highly desirable residency. I feel like privileged, honored, and, you know, lucky to have gotten it. The highlights have been, there was a behind-the-scenes tour I got mm-hmm. at the Visitor Center, and that was the cyclorama up close and from underneath and where other people can't see it. And the incredible part are all the archives, the archival objects that they have. So, you know, the books, the paper knowledge, the maps, the swords, just amazing things. General Lee's saddle. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. It's not on exhibit. I saw it. You know, I didn't touch it because that's not okay. But so that was intense. And the way actually that people love the park and donate these things, like people will spend $250,000 at auction and give it to the park because the park can't obviously afford that. Mm-hmm. And because they believe in the archival purpose and mm-hmm. how objects add to that, etc. Then the tour, they give us a certified tour guide, mm-hmm. and those aren't cheap. And our guide took us, I and the other artist this month, on the tour that he gives through the town to where the battle started, and he's standing there, and he's it's so different. I mean, I've been on so many things like this where you get the map and you read the blurbs at the dot, and then you get out and you read the little, you know, interpretation mm-hmm. display. But to have someone there and describing anecdotal bloody pieces of information, you know, like the creeks ran red literally for 3 days, and to, you know, the blood from all the bot, you know, seeping down and the, you know, to stand there and make a sweep of his hands, you know, from way to the left to way to the right. That tree line over there was just a tree line, and then 3,000 Confederate soldiers emerged, you know, mm-hmm. From the trees, like a force of nature coming towards you. And what are your chances? 1 in 2?
Mm-hmm.
Not good. And the fear, you know, that was in there, and they did it anyway, because they believed in their cause, that the Union should be together, that fractions were weaker than being united, and not for everyone, but, you know, emancipation. There's so many people believed in that. Although, you know, now they correct, not everybody, so that's true. But just, and that they did it for us, you know, they don't know us. They did it for the future. You know, people who can't know anything about our lives now wanted it to be better.
Hmm.
So that was very intense, and I highly recommend it. It is worth the money, and he was great. And then the last 2 days, and a little bit more today, I hope, I've been in the cannon shop, which, first of all, how cool is that, right?
That's got to be one of the coolest things ever.
You know, it's like the best man cave on earth, right? And I am a woman who loves man caves. So there's cannons in there. There's, you know, it's a metal shop. It's a forge. They do casting. I mean, there's some few woodworking tools, whatever, but it's all in the service of, say, the bronze plaques, or repairing the statues in the park, or keeping the cannons looking awesome, and a lot of other things that end up needing repair and or being made from scratch. And they've been helping me with this metal because, you know, I watched a YouTube video on how to cast it yourself in your backyard, and I was like, oh man, look at that, I'm going to be doing this in no time. Well, there's a reason why people go to school for years to learn how. So it's been a struggle, but they've helped me come up with the product that I want, which are these about inch high metal letters. Actually, the molds are those, you know, those little plastic letters you get on the fridge for kids to spell stuff out.
The different colored.
Yeah. They're all caps. And you think you can spell things, and it's always later you're like, oh, it's just one set of the alphabet, so you can't spell here because
right.
there's two E's.
Uh-huh.
But, which is why I'm casting them. So, you know, I'm getting enough to make a prototype. It's only been 2 weeks. I had another residency already when I accepted, when they offered this to me, and I thought I had to turn it down. And Tanya, the woman who's in charge of the National Parks Arts Foundation, went and, you know, talked to people and came back and offered me, say, well, we'd like to offer you the second half because we really like your project, and we think you'll get a lot out of it, and vice versa. So, I mean, how flattering is that, right? So I'm like, okay. It's nice when people respond to your ideas. So,
And you had done a lot of research in preparation for your proposal, right?
That's right. Well, I even made a proposal last year that was not accepted, and I put like 80 hours into it. It was about Elizabeth Thorne, the woman who, after the battle, she was 7 months pregnant in July, and it's hot, and there's bodies everywhere. She buried 217 bodies by herself for the last 2 months of her pregnancy, when people don't even want to leave the air conditioning because, you know, that's terrible. And she wasn't paid any extra for it. She just did it to keep her family's position as the Evergreen Cemetery caretakers. Mm-hmm. You know, if she didn't, they wouldn't. And her husband's away with the Union Army. Mm-hmm. So it's really incredible what she did. And so, well, that's a whole different thing. But so I'd done all that preparation. So this year I tried again, and I was going to rewrite that one. But then when I had this idea with the GPS coordinates and stuff, I just, it's funny. I will start out with a, I don't know, shouldn't give this away, but I actually start out with a very mercenary thing, like, I'm going to get this. You know, what do they want to hear? But then when I do the research, it always comes around that I'm passionate about the project I end up with. So I don't feel guilty about that first sort of competitive thoughts, because those thoughts, I mean, the research will, I magnetize towards the things that mesh with what interests me. And when the idea finally comes, I'm, you know, so I love this idea. I probably in 2 weeks I can't, but they're okay with that. In fact, they told me, I found this to be very moving. One of the first things they do is, you know, when you get the behind-the-scenes tour, is that the purpose of the residency is not for the park to get a collection of contemporary art. I mean, they like having these objects and the record, but they really are passionate about increasing the diversity of the people coming to the park. So their prime audience right now are men between 50 and white guys between 50 and 70 years old. And that's how they put it to me. And they would love to see, you know, for them to continue to come, but for a different demographic to also get that feeling that I got, that this was really done for all of us. This park belongs to all of us. This is not just for a certain type of person that you may associate with, you know, historical reenactments or, I mean, not that those aren't diverse, but you know what I mean? So for us to literally take the spirit of it away with us, and whether we do art about Gettysburg or not, the fact that we are changed by it and go out and our art will reflect that sensibility that we talked, you know, I mean, artists really are the vanguard of what's next. Whether it's gentrification or, you know, they're the early adopters of ideas. And they're also the mixers of ideas. You know, like I am into literature, educational theory, objects, video, things like that, experiential art. And the fact that I am having an intense experience, and I go from here, and what I like to think of what my work is a sort of constructed opportunity for experience. The fact that I'm taking this and what I'm learning from this, and that's just naturally going to percolate through my work, is what they want. That's the goal. But also that other people, you know, that can spread and reach other people. And frankly, it's also working in a direct way. I mean, I have, like, I don't know, 1,200 Facebook friends. And I've just been posting on my artist page, you know, video, photos, what I remember from my tour, the Cannon Shop. So you know, it's already worked. I mean, if mm-hmm. that's their goal, and some audience has been, you know, a lot of my former students, you know, young people in their 20s mm-hmm. and stuff like that have been like, whoa. And so, and some of them are movers and shakers themselves, I have to say. So it'll be interesting to see when the, you know, you'll see more 20-year-old Hispanic college students coming in.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, is there anything else that you would like to say about your research-based practice?
Yes, that was something that was stressed at my grad school, School mm-hmm. of Visual Arts. And there's a lot of different MFA programs. My program was called Artist Practice, so mm-hmm. it's not metals, it's not painting, and it tends to be older, not old, older than other departments, and they say, you're old enough that we know you can teach yourself anything, and you probably have, like in terms of materials. So what this program is about is thinking. How does an artist practice? How do you construct meaning? How, you know, you need to think about your practice, which of course appeals to me because what is that? Thinking about thinking, becoming metacognitive. Right. So, you know, actually, I think I just put that together right now. I'm always the last to know these things. So I'm sure that's why I was attracted to the program and why it was a good fit. And so research is strongly emphasized, and not in the sense of a paper with, although we did have to write a paper, with footnotes, but that, again, well, like I said before, no one cares how you feel. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I feel about Gettysburg? Well, how about if I think about Gettysburg, I learn about Gettysburg, my feeling will actually, and I do have feelings about it, will lead me to something deeper, you know, the bone yeah. under the flesh, mm-hmm. you know, like the there's a Molly Peacock poem about petting and being a pet. And how when you pet an animal, you're not just running across the fur, you're pressing down and you're feeling the bone and the muscle, and that's kind of what it's about, and the underlying structure. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I want my research to be. My research is, you know, experiencing what there is and until I encounter what it is that I'm reaching for. I don't know what that is necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I don't start out with an idea. I just read. Then I get, you know, tired of facts. So I go read poetry or other people's experiences. I actually read a lot of contemporary poetry as well, about Gettysburg or the Civil mm-hmm. War. And, you know, it's beautiful too. I mean, sometimes you're kind of getting to the same point, but our contemporary sensibility can be, we want to get there through different words, mm-hmm. you know, like, I mean, I love Walt Whitman's poem, "O Captain, My Captain," you know, but we don't talk like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know what it would be today, but it would be phrased differently in a way that spoke to us more directly, because we're always remaking language and we're mm-hmm. always, but it's the same feelings, you know, mm-hmm. but we need to hear it in our pitch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've been listening to The Seminary Explores. I'm your host, Katie Giebenhain. My guest has been artist Brandy Martin Yu. Brandy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.